Hello and welcome to episode 29 of WB40, the weekly tech podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston. So here we are again, Chris. Summer's back. How's it going?
Yeah, hooray for summer. Yeah, very well, thank you. Another exciting week has just gone by. Last week I was in Bristol, I was in Manchester, and I also went to an event around HS2, the enormous construction project which is set to rule all our lives for the next few years.
Do you live anywhere near the route of HS2?
Yeah, not too far. So HS2 obviously goes from London to Birmingham, the first stage, and so Birmingham is south of me, but there's a branch that comes up from Birmingham, not too far away from me, about 3 or 4 miles away, and then starts to head up north. So that first part has got an effect, and some people near here are affected. Certainly when I was at this event, and I went on behalf of a number of people I work with, really, to see what the potential for doing some business in that area was, and also certainly around the IoT side of my life, there it seems to me that by the time they start it, the problem is it's such a massive project, it will outstrip in terms of capacity most of what we have in this country around cranes and construction equipment and lifting equipment, all that kind of thing. We'll have to have a national capacity management program to provide all of the stuff it needs. And I can see there being scope for some innovative thinking around IoT and things like that, so at least we know where everything is. That was quite interesting. A bunch of other stuff as well. But the requirement, especially because we're not just building HS2, assuming that we do, but we're also building Hinkley Point, and there might be one or two other infrastructure projects that come up in the next, well, certainly during the lifetime of HS2. So, yeah, exciting times for the construction industry.
We don't seem to have very much headroom in terms of capacity in the UK for anything significant to happen, really, do we? It's like everything, any big major project, you kind of, that's all the resource used.
Well, I think a lot of it contracted after 2007, after the crash. If there was any spare capacity, it was a mothballed or it was got rid of. You know, we're in the construction and engineering world, that was a really, really hard time. And we didn't get any support from government at that time either. So we had unique engineering plants in this country being essentially denied piffling sums of money to do projects which would have kept them going, but they had to close because they just didn't have the work. And now we don't have those facilities. So, for example, we can't now build the core of a nuclear reactor in this country. We can't cast the parts. We have to do that elsewhere. Whereas up until about 10 years ago, we had that facility, but it all had to get closed down and scrapped because there was no need for it anymore, and nobody would keep it going. So, we have contracted quite a lot, but I guess for the Bamfords of this world, it'll be a good time.
Indeed, of course, we as a country now can focus on matters digital. And I saw you noted that the Department for Culture, Media and Sport has now become the Department for Digital Culture and Media and Sport, but is only having one D in its title.
That's right, and they could have come up with far better acronyms, I'm sure, given an extra D. They could have had DD Mac and all sorts, but now it's going to be it's going to stay as DCMS, but the D is now digital. And there we go. We said, didn't we? Didn't we say just a few weeks ago that we needed to get digital back on the government agenda, and we've got a minister for digital. So who knows? That might be a brave new dawn. And they announced £400 million for infrastructure investment. I thought it was 200. Then I saw a number that's 400 million to install, you know, new broadband services, fibre. which does seem like I don't know whether you heard the Today program this morning. There was a challenge by the chap Webb, I think, talking to the minister and saying, you know, this 200 million is a bit piffling, really. We've got billions being spent on HS2, but you know, this is in this new digital world. And I think we've both made this point over the 29 episodes or so of this podcast. Yeah, it's about moving people around from between London and Birmingham is a fairly Victorian concept, whereas moving data about seems to be, you know, ideas and data would seem to be the next step, really.
So episode 29, and it's about time we started a conversation about the blockchain. This is something that has reached probably about complete hype peak at the moment. I know when you have groups of professionals going around saying we're going to become specialist in blockchain, that you've probably got a point where there is money to be made from unaware in customers who don't know any better. So what we're going to do this evening is to just unpack a little bit about blockchain, what it is, how it works, a bit about where it's being talked about, as it may be a technology that may apply, and then just to think about actually should anybody care. It's been something that's been around. I think I've blogged about the value of blockchain, which is the thing that is the distributed ledger system. And actually, we should probably be talking about distributed ledgers rather than blockchain itself, because blockchain is one instance of this thing. But I was first writing about this a few years ago now when I was thinking about Bitcoin, which is where the blockchain came from, and being very suspicious of the motivations behind Bitcoin itself, but understanding that the underlying technology might be of use. And so it seems that the hype is going with it. Give us a relatively straightforward, if you can, Chris, definition about what a distributed ledger actually is.
Well, as you say, Matt, it came from the whole Bitcoin phenomenon, didn't it? And cryptocurrencies generally. The idea that somebody wanted to find a way that they could manage a transaction between two people without having a central trusted entity in the middle. So at the moment, if I want to send you £10, I might send it by PayPal, and PayPal really will be the thing in the middle. It will take £10 from me. It would make sure that I had £10 with which to give you, and then it would give you £10. And in the middle, there will be PayPal getting its cut, I guess. That they have they make money somehow. I can't remember quite how it is, but they do. Or in the traditional world, it would be a bank. And when the guys who invented Bitcoin and the later cryptocurrencies came along, they wanted to find a way to take that away. So blockchain essentially is as you say, it's a distributed ledger, and all of the processing, all of those transactions take place in a series of locations. There's not one central location, but not only is the ledger distributed, but the processing effort is distributed as well. So we all have to host blockchain processing kit, or we don't. You know, you can use blockchain without hosting any of it, but you, in order for it to work, there has to be some gain in running the kit. So in terms of cryptocurrency, you could run kit that was sat there and processed blockchain transactions and did the hashing for the encryption, and you would earn bitcoins or bits of bitcoins. I can't remember whether you could earn full bitcoins or whatever, but you remember this term of Bitcoin mining. So you would sit there and your computer would sit there and it would mine bitcoins. It would do these calculations and it would be rewarded with bitcoins. When you start to look at different applications, so if you're thinking about running a distributed ledger for a logistics platform to be able to manage and measure transactions, shipping, you know, motor parts or whatever, then People will need to host this network because they want it to succeed, rather than in order to gain some financial benefit. So at the end of the day, the Bitcoin example is a fantastic example of how blockchain works, but it's not a great analog for later implementations in a commercial environment, because there's no benefit from running the processing power, if you know what I mean, unless you set up some sort of secondary benefit where you're giving away some sort of value that the network has to the people running the kit.
Do you think there's a chance that it could end up, as you were talking there, it reminded me a little of the early peer-to-peer networks, so things like Napster or the video file sharing networks that expanded at pace before they all got sort of squished a bit. And the everybody's device there in those systems were part of the distributed serving network. And the thing that was, if you wanted to be part of it, then you needed to be able to offer up some of your computing power and some of your network power to be able to deliver it. But it seems that with the blockchain stuff now, and with, I was chatting to somebody today who's mining Ethereum, and just looked at him like he was, you know, from another planet. But basically, he's just got a computer that's sitting there burning GPU cycles, and it's giving him like 20p every 2 days. And he's only doing it because he's got an office where he's got free electricity. It reminded me, funnily enough, of the thing in Northern Ireland where people were burning wood just for the sake of being able to make money from it in farm barns. And it, you know, these kind of Bitcoin mining things appear to be a little bit like those kind of scams, quite frankly. But do you think we'll get to a point where it will just become peer-to-peer based, that actually you don't need massive computing power to be able to do that? Or is the massive computing power needed for the cryptography part and parcel of these things working?
You don't need massive computing power. It is distributed, absolutely. You can run, I saw Bitcoin processors being run on a USB key, essentially. The USB key would contain, it wasn't a USB key, it was a USB, it wasn't a memory key, it was a USB device with a GPU on it, which essentially was built specifically for mining Bitcoin. And you could plug one of these into your computer and it would sit there chewing away relatively slowly, but eventually, you know, occasionally it would earn you something. So the processing power per se doesn't, you know, in terms of individual parts, doesn't have to be big, just like your Napster example or your SETI at home or all of those kind of distributed computer projects. It's more about, does the whole system have enough beef to process all the transactions? And as you know, just like you, I know people with GPUs lined up in a room, you know, the room was red hot when you went in it because of the amount of processing that was going on. But they reckon they earned more than enough to pay the electric bill, and it meant they didn't have to turn their heating on in the house. So it worked that way for them. So yeah, I think it can work. But that's in a fairly, a bit like Napster or something like that, a fairly not chaotic but you know, kind of self-serving environment where everybody. If it doesn't work today, it's not the end of the world. You come back tomorrow and maybe the person that's sharing that file will be there. If you're trying to use this for a commercial project, and there are lots of examples of blockchain projects going, especially into the logistics space. I read about one in Antwerp earlier this week, which is I think Maersk did one in Dubai recently as well. It's about managing transactions in a logistics setting. So when you're handling lots of different people, lots of different stakeholders, bringing containers in, because of course the container has to be delivered by a ship, and then it has to be handled by the port, and then the things on the container have got different owners and have to go to different places. So you've got lots of different stakeholders involved, lots of things like faxes and emails and telephone calls, and they're wrapping all that around a blockchain platform. When that's got to happen, then you need it to work all the time, and therefore you need to invest in the tin, either to say, okay, everybody involved in this little wheeze has to run some of this kit, or we're going to get a platform provider to do it for us. but everybody has to have a stake in it, really, for it to work.
And because we are starting to see established organisations for whom it was initially lauded that these distributed ledgers would be the end of them. So people like banks, people like big tech companies, people like big shipping lines and whatever, starting to say that they're going to be, or they are doing stuff with distributed ledger. Doesn't that kind of defeat the purpose of it in a way? Because isn't the whole point of it, the trust is within the technology, not within the brand of the organization that's delivering it?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a bit of, we must get onto this before we are disintermediated away by it. I think there are a lot of those trusted bodies that are kind of fearful of what Bitcoin might do to them, but they are some of the biggest investors in it, and I think they can see potential for if they invest in it, provide the platform, and then provide some value-added services around it, it might still be profitable for them. But it's identifying what those value-added services are. I mean, insurance is a good example. If you take so one of the great things about Bitcoin, not Bitcoin, blockchain, is that you can attach a smart contract to it. So you can say, if these different things happen, then we will pay some money. An outcome will mean that you get paid for it. So again, nobody has to be involved in the measurement of that. It's just something that happens through the blockchain logic. Insurance, of course, is a form of institutionalized form of gambling, isn't it? Where you bet on something happening, and if it happens, then you get some money. The insurance companies are looking at this as a way to automate some of the things they do. Now that takes away some of their value, but if you're an insurance company, what you're really doing is you're providing value around experience and expertise in an area, aren't you? If you insure aircraft, you should be experts in aircraft. You should be experts in how they're operated. You should be experts in where they're going to, the airports they're landing in. You're understanding what the risks are of operating a flight between two locations and operating a flight with a pilot with a certain amount of experience against a pilot with another amount of experience, so that you can create a premium that matches the risk for that airline. So all of the stuff in the middle, the processing of claims and the loss adjustment and all of that kind of thing, yes, that's important, but that's not really where the value is. It's kind of that's the turn of the handle. So I think insurance companies, for example, see risk in things like blockchain, but they also, if they've got their head screwed on, they see an opportunity to really show where their value is.
Okay, so we've talked already about a couple of potential applications for these distributed ledgers. Let's have a look at a few more examples of where people are currently talking about them being of potential interest. The most obvious starting point is in terms of money, because that's where Bitcoin is very much focused. My own thoughts on these kind of cryptocurrencies, and something I've written about a few times now, is actually underpinning it, it's issues of trust. And in fact, actually everything about distributed ledgers is about technology to be able to enable trust to be embedded in technology. And the thing that strikes me about cryptocurrencies is that there is an assumption that people have lost trust in money. And I'm not convinced that's the case. I think actually, if trust has been lost in the last 10 years or so, it's in financial institutions, not money itself. I don't think anybody has any problem with, whether the £5 note in their pocket is going to be honoured, whether your bank is going to be around next month or not, or is only going to be around because of a massive government bailout, is probably something that's of more concern to more people. Do you think cryptocurrencies are going to be a thing, or do we think that pounds and euros and dollars will reign supreme in the world?
I think things with vested interests tend to happen, don't they? So I don't see traditional currencies going anywhere soon. But I do see a consistent attack on the status quo from the digital economy and the way that organisations now work. I think we talked about this. Didn't we talk about this when we talked about Brexit a few weeks ago? In as much as a lot of the conversations that we tend to see now between governments are about, okay, well, there are going to be tariffs, and we're going to that's going to harm our trade, etc. Because we're going to stop you from sending your business over here, because we're going to be protectionist about it, and we're going to raise tariffs. Whereas nowadays, if I can give you a service, especially in these days of what we might call free software, the Facebooks and the Twitters of this world, their model is based on your information, the data you provide about yourself that allows other people to sell you stuff. So I could provide you with a service. Maybe it's a CRM system, or it's a music platform or whatever it might be, from Bermuda. And you don't have to send me money. I can provide this to you in exchange for non-financial things. I can provide it in exchange for your shopping information. So you can't put a tariff on that. You can't easily measure that. And I think at the moment, those transactions are small compared to other things. But as people find ways of sending goods, services, and then ways of remunerating each other that are tariff-free, that don't go through national boundaries, I think that will start to become used. Because, of course, how are you going to stop people? Well, unless you have a worldwide auditing frenzy of everybody sort of cracking down on it, I think it's going to become very difficult.
So there's something in that about there being applications for distributed ledgers where you have a need for trust in transactions between anonymous parties, which, if I'm going to get all Daily Mail on you for a moment, is basically it's the ideal currency for drug dealers and weapons dealers. What I don't quite get is where people talk about wanting to have transactions that can be trusted where the parties are known. So things like, so for example, there's quite a lot of talk about, and I've seen this in law firms as well, talk about being able to use distributed ledgers to be able to record things like property transactions. What would be the benefit of that?
Well, I guess if you're not relying on a third party to manage all of that, then that's a significant cost out of your system. That entity doesn't have to be there. If you're essentially trusting the technology to manage that trust piece. Now that's a kind of idealistic answer. I think that, so for somebody asked me today, actually we were chatting about this, and they said, well, how does the blockchain stop you from entering false information? And of course, the blockchain really doesn't. I mean, it can in some cases. You can tell the system can say, well, you don't have 10 bitcoins to send to Matt, so we're not having that. But if we are measuring a delivery, to say that I have delivered something to your house, and if I enter to the blockchain and say that delivery has been made, and we haven't got a mutually agreed way of saying that has happened, then that goes on the blockchain. I guess what you can't do then is deny that you did that. If when it comes back to somebody checking and saying that, well, that was false, it's pretty much you're bang to rights. So I think there's a level of reality. You can't go back on the stuff that you've entered. But then who decides that there should be a sanction for that? Well, then you come back to a third party, don't you?
Yeah, and also that there's something that makes me slightly nervous about any technology that says the cryptography on this is so great that it can never, ever be hacked, because that's a very brash claim to make about any sort of technology. And so if the trust has to go into something that's effectively, for most people, a black box of unintelligible gubbins, that question of trust becomes very, very, very complicated. And is it possible for us to be able to place trust in extremely complicated inanimate objects? Because for that, for the whole premise of this to work, that's what we've got to do. Now we do, and we do it day in, day out. We carry the polycarbonate slabs of glass in our pockets, and we trust that it's doing. In fact, we don't even know what it's doing. It's listening to me at the moment, this thing in my hand. I don't know what is going on with the data that it is listening. It's listening to you as well. So maybe we can actually put trust into things, even though we don't understand them and don't understand what they are doing, and they might inherently be untrustworthy anyway. But I'm not sure, is that a greater, because a lot of the examples for blockchain technologies that I've seen have generally been about removing relatively trusted institutions and putting the trust instead into a group of computer programmers who are abstracted away from the thing. We have no idea about who they are. I mean, literally, with blockchain, we have no idea who these people are. And so there's a really weird thing at a psychological and social level there about what does trust mean in the modern age, and why don't we trust institutions, and why could we see trust being given to code?
I think that's true, but I think that's down to how deeply do people really fundamentally understand these things. So when you send your transaction over the internet, how do you know that it's secure? You know, yeah, you've got a little padlock in the top left hand corner and it says HTTPS, but who really knows how that security really works, and who really knows that particular certificate is correct, or how, you know, when you send a message over the internet, you've no idea which way it goes. It could go via France, it could go via Germany, it could go via Spain. You've just no idea. That's not how the internet works. The internet works as a resilient network. So you're right, we do. We put our trust in these things that are inherently unknowable, other than to people who, you know, with sharp heads and lots of pens in their pocket. That's not unusual. I think going back to the blockchain part, one of the reasons why, I mean, it really is highly encrypted. And I think if Bitcoin, if you could take down Bitcoin, that somebody would have done it by now. But you have to lay that off against the fact that because it's so secure, if you delete your Bitcoin wallet, that's it. You've lost your money. If you somehow lose that little bit of software, that's it. There's no way of getting it back. And that's not necessarily a place where people want to be with their corporate data. So there, I'm certainly not somebody who thinks that the blockchain is a panacea and an end to problems. Actually, I think it's a really elegant technology, almost a brilliant way of handling some of these transactions. I'm not necessarily sure it brings with it fewer problems than it takes away, but there are enough people putting money into this. There's the Hyperledger project from IBM. There's all the banks are investing billions in research in this technology. So somebody thinks it's got a future, and it might be hype. You know, I'm trying to think of a technology. You must be able to think of a technology in the last 20 years that people have put a lot of money in but has never gone anywhere.
3D television.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, and it's whether it is 3D, you know, is distributed ledger a 3D television, or is it a smartphone? That's the question. Yeah. That's the question. So answering that, or trying to answer that question about should you be, you know, putting money onto this and into this at this stage, brings us to the question of, well, what should you do? What practically, if you are a technology manager, if you are a business leader, what should you be doing about distributed ledgers now? First thing that strikes me is educating yourself about it so that you can't be sold horseshit, which is the stock in trade of the technology industry. Are there products you think at the moment that anybody should be looking at in any great seriousness and actually, you know, buying and implementing that use distributed ledger technologies?
I wouldn't say there are any standout technologies that you simply must buy. It's a no-brainer. I think that if you're developing technology, if you own technology and you're looking to how it might develop, then you can go and you can go to Azure and you can, you know, there's blockchain as a service, so you can get Ethereum and various other blockchain databases, and you can spin up in Azure for nothing, and your development team maybe could use them and say, okay, well, how does this work for us? And I think it wouldn't hurt for organizations to try some of these technologies. I think there are some quite interesting technologies. Somebody asked a few weeks ago about copyright. So there are services for managing copyright for images and artwork and things like that that are blockchain based. There was a good example of a proof of concept. I'm not entirely sure whether it went into production, but it was around insurance. Again, it was around flight insurance. So people would buy flight insurance to say that it would pay out if the flight didn't take off. And then it was all blockchain based. And then the smart contract was connected to the flight status services now, that you can see where flights are in the world and how fast they're going and where they're coming from and where they're heading to. So it was connected to one of those services. And so essentially it was a binary decision. If your flight didn't take off at the time it was supposed to, then the smart contract was activated and you got your money. So I think it's worth keeping an eye on these things and seeing, what's coming into your industry. But no, I think it would be drawing a long bow to say that somebody should go out and implement a Bitcoin, a blockchain solution today.
There's interesting, just a couple of observations about that I think are really curious about what is a new technology, is that actually there's a couple of examples that we've been talking about that actually a new technology is being used to try to be able to recreate the world before digital. So the idea of being able to recreate anonymity in a world where everybody is becoming increasingly identified is really interesting, because that's about taking us back. That's not actually taking us forward. And when you're talking then about copyright, now, one of the really interesting things about the use of distributed ledgers to enforce copyright would be attempting to be able to recreate the world where copyright was defensible and implementable, which, of course, the world of digital is pretty much destroyed. And actually, for me, the forward-looking way of doing that is Creative Commons, to be able to say we can't restrict people copying things anymore because the cost of copying is zero, so therefore people will copy. So, acknowledge that and build mechanisms to do that. Distributed ledgers being able to take us back to the world of copyright. And that, in both of those instances, you could see how, well, particularly the copyright one, that the real driver there will be the vested interests of large IP owners rather than in establishing new ways. I don't know whether there's anything more in that, but it does strike me just as curious that it's some of these early definitions are about being able to protect the old world in the digital realm rather than about creating entirely new things in the digital realm.
I think that's true, actually. There's an example of a blockchain application which is for time stamping. So it allows you to time stamp a video and say when it was taken, which so when I first saw a requirement for this a few years ago working in criminal justice, where you'd have video of an incident, for example, but if you're going to have it admissible in court, the court would have to understand and know that the video had not been tampered with. There was a way of knowing exactly when that video was taken. And the guys had come up with a way of doing that and embedding information into the video itself. But there are blockchain services now that allow you to do that. And because, of course, there's an immutability about the blockchain, that means that you can timestamp these things. So again, that's taking something which has become very flexible and fluid. You can watch a video now on TV, can't you, a film, and you're not really sure whether it's something that happened or whether it's CGI. The reality has become so blurred by the quality of CGI that some of these services are taking us back to saying, no, this really happened and this is when it happened. So that's a good example of what you're saying.
I guess the other question then for all of this is, ultimately, should anybody really care? If you're not investing in technology, and I think a lot of blockchain claim at the moment is about being able to show that you've pressed the right buttons to get the right investors as opposed to anything really useful. If you're a technologist and you are looking at how you might develop platforms, then it could be of value, da da da. It does strike me, though, that we probably are at a point now where the hype about the technology is at its peak, that effectively, distributed ledgers are quite a low-level infrastructural part of anything that they'll ever be used for in the future. And ultimately, it's a bit like today saying powered by SQL Server, in that actually nobody really cares and it's of no consequence to the end users whatsoever. And I wonder, actually, if distributed ledgers do become a important thing, they'll be an important thing in the way that, you know, we never think about electric motors or blue LEDs or any of these things, which are so embedded into our day-to-day lives that it's just, they're not important anymore.
I completely agree. I completely agree. There's no way that people care about their, who cares whether Netflix, if they're watching, I don't know, The Crown on Netflix, who cares whether the server that is running that is running in a private cloud or on an Intel chip or an AMD chip, it's running, who cares about that? I don't care about it, and not many people should care about it. And this stuff should be encapsulated away from the people taking the service, absolutely. When you need to give some credibility to what you're doing and tell your board why it costs 10 times more to do it than an alternative, you can point to all of the great stuff that goes around it, the security and the availability and et cetera. But no, absolutely not. You might want to know that where the tuna in your sandwich comes from and when it was caught and who the fisherman's name was, but you probably don't. And this is a similar situation, I think. So there we go. That's another week.
I know. It shoots past, doesn't it?
And I think we've successfully covered the whole blockchain issue. I'm sure there are things that we've missed out that the loyal listenership will write in to tell us about. But it was a good conversation. Does the week hold for you, Matt? What are you looking forward to?
Week ahead is the kind of last bits of preparation for the minimum viable workplace workshop that we've got going on the 13th. Probably still squeeze one or two more people in there if anybody's interested. Get in touch if you are. I've also made a start on my presentation for Silicon Beach, which I'm very pleased about because it's a labour of love, because I want it to be good, because I'm up against, that makes it sound competitive. I am on the same stage as a number of people who are very, 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 very good at talking and stuff. So I'm doing an entire talk about imposter syndrome, which seems to be appropriate enough. How about you?
So this week I've got, I'm doing a leadership course for some people up in the Northwest. And I've got an article in FM World. If FM World is a magazine that drops through your door, Matt, that's in there this week. And I've got a couple of pitches.
Wouldn't drop through my doormat. It would get stopped by my doormat.
I've got a couple of pitches for customers as well with various of their clients, so which is exciting, because that's the kind of stuff that makes me happy when we win those things. So yeah, it's a really it's quite a good week, this.
Yeah, good. Have fun.
And you.
So there we go. I hope you enjoyed it. Catch us again next week. You can stay in touch with the show at wb40podcast.com or on Twitter at wb40podcast. See you next week.